This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode on diagnosing bipolar disorder. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. On the surface, Abigail Kafka's life seems pretty nice and fairly ordinary.
I'm 45 years old, and I live on the outskirts of Berlin with my husband, our books, and a bunch of houseplants.
Abigail is a writer.
During the week, I usually load my laptop onto my bike and ride along the river to work. After work, I go to the gym. Then I ride home and cook dinner. We watch I Love Lucy.
Oh boy, does this look good. Mmm, it is good.
Sundays, we often go for a walk in the woods and make tacos.
But there's a very different life Abigail used to lead, a backstory that she's kept hidden away.
I used to avoid talking about my past. As far as I was concerned, my life started in 2014, just like my LinkedIn profile.
But the backstory resurfaced when Abigail started therapy during the pandemic. She opened up to her therapist about her past and about the things she'd been through.
When I finished, she paused. She put her pen to her lips. Then she said, "That's not normal." It's not what anyone expects to hear from a therapist, so it caught me by surprise. "It's not?" I asked her. She looked at me and said, "No, it's not." To explain what she meant, I have to go back to that time I used to avoid talking about.
And that journey back made her question a diagnosis she had gotten decades earlier, which completely upended her life, bipolar disorder. She decided to investigate that part of her past.
I wanted to check in with someone who was around when I was 19 and a student at Columbia University. So I called up my friend Robert. He's known me my entire life.
Okay, now I'm recording.
We were hanging out together in New York in 1999.
I remember that you were young and smart and ambitious and adventurous.
Freshman year was rough. I was lonely. I got mono. So I took a leave of absence. I tried going back to school in the spring, but things only got worse. I was taking classes and working as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress. Then I had a bad breakup with someone I was seeing, and one afternoon in my dorm room, I hurt myself. It was spontaneous, but on purpose. And it wasn't potentially fatal, but it was serious enough that I got scared and called Robert.
And I remember saying, "You can't be screwing around." I must have hung up because I had to call 911.
Robert met me in the emergency room. And after a couple of hours, I was discharged into his care.
It felt like it was going to be okay. It didn't feel dangerous.
Two or three days later, my parents flew me home to San Diego to see a psychiatrist. He wrote me a prescription for Celexa, a common antidepressant. Once I was back at school, I had some bad side effects from the medication, which really freaked me out. I reported this to the psychologist at my university, and he told me to go to New York Hospital, just to get stabilized, he said. When I arrived there, I was locked in a yellow padded room. I was terrified and angry, but when I protested, they injected me with an antipsychotic. I woke up in a hospital bed. It was totally surreal. Later on, I was transferred to a ward on the 9th floor in a wheelchair. Robert came to visit me there.
I remember like just these lights with a green tint, like on a different planet. I remember worrying, not really understanding the depth of your condition.
I ended up staying there for about 2 weeks. Then my dad checked me out of the hospital and took me back home. I was so zonked out on medications that I wasn't fully aware of what was happening. In the span of 3 or 4 weeks, I had been locked in an institution, kicked out of school, and completely uprooted from my life as an independent adult. All of these decisions were being made for me. I wasn't even really aware that they were being made. my dad sent me to a new psychiatrist who gave me a new label, bipolar. Bipolar, he said, is the reason I acted out. It explained everything. Suddenly, I was a patient with a serious mental illness. And this is what I would be for the next 15 years of my life. This story isn't about those 15 years. They were both horrifying and boring. I saw many, many doctors. I was on more psychiatric medications than I could count. I remember I was dating someone at the time. They thought it was so cute that whenever I saw them, I was trembling with emotion. I never told them it was the lithium. But more than the side effects, like tremors and weight gain, I was constantly getting fired from jobs for reasons I didn't understand.
We just think you're overqualified for this position.
Unfortunately, we don't have any room for you on the schedule.
In this economy, we need someone who puts everything into this business.
We have decided to let you go.
I would make friends, and we would start hanging out, going to the beach, trading clothes, and then it would all suddenly stop, with no explanation. For years, I couldn't go to the grocery store or out to eat. I spent endless days, weeks, months, alone, unable to leave my one-room apartment, sometimes smoking and watching reality TV on my laptop, sometimes just listening to the ceiling fan whir and click above me. Eventually, I was designated disabled by the state of California. I felt like everyone understood something about how to live in the world that I just couldn't grasp. But there was one doctor during that whole 15-year stretch who helped me see a way out of my life as a patient.
My name is Jeremy Flagel. I am a psychiatrist currently living in Bend, Oregon. Used to live in San Diego where you and I met.
I started seeing Dr. Flagel in 2007, about 8 years into my treatment for bipolar disorder. My life was a mess, but a quiet mess. I hadn't had any kind of crisis or episode for years at that point. I asked him what he remembers about meeting me.
I have a very good picture of, you know, the office, of the room, where you were sitting. I remember you chose the chair sort of in the corner.
I wondered what he thought about the bipolar diagnosis I'd come in with.
I remember having this thought at when this diagnosis was made by these people who I think were good and been doing their job for a really long time, that, hey, this must be what it is.
He also remembered that I came to him on a bunch of medications that I wasn't sure I wanted to take.
Like the entire umbrella of our conversation was, how do I live my life as I want to live it without pharmaceuticals? And both of us trying to figure out if we're brave enough to do that together.
And here's the thing. Eventually, I was. It took me 7 years. But in April 2014, I took my last pill.
Can I ask what it's like remembering that?
I feel that that's probably the most myself I was since I got the diagnosis.
Makes me really happy to hear that, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
And this is the part my therapist in Berlin said is not normal. I haven't been on medication for over 10 years. In 10 years, I haven't had any mental health crises. My therapist said people with bipolar disorder don't just get off their medications and live a normal life. So as I was hearing this, I was thinking, wait, what? What does that mean? Do I have some sort of superpower? Or did I waste 15 years of my life for nothing? It was so jarring that I couldn't even grasp the other possibility, probably the obvious one, that maybe those doctors my dad sent me to were wrong, that maybe I didn't have bipolar disorder. I couldn't sort this all out during the therapy session. But afterward, I started thinking about it, wondering, why was I diagnosed as bipolar? What made my doctor so sure about that? And how much of those harrowing 15 years of treatment boiled down to that one label? I wanted answers. And since I'm a writer, I decided to go about this the best way I can, by writing about it, and maybe rewriting my own history. I reached out to Justin Cramon, a reporter and producer, to help me investigate and tell this story.
So the first thing I did was to contact a doctor named Mark Rego. He teaches psychiatry at Yale Medical School and was a practicing psychiatrist for 25 years. We found an article where he argues that overdiagnosis of bipolar is a big issue in the U.S.
Justin and I asked if he'd answer some questions about my bipolar diagnosis. I started by telling him my history, about the crisis I'd had in college, and the bad reaction to the medication.
So, none of that says you're bipolar.
I told him about getting off all the medications.
Have you been medication-free and living your life since then?
I've been medication-free since 2014.
If you are bipolar and you go off your medicine, you are going to relapse within months.
I was amazed by how absolutely he made this statement. But there was more.
When I was in practice, I just had a stream of people coming to me diagnosed with bipolar disorder with no evidence to support it.
He explained, bipolar disorder is characterized by an alternating pattern of depression and mania. Mania is the key component. Not sleeping for days, having racing thoughts, being highly active. People feel on top of the world. But it gets dangerous. The elevated moods make you do irrational and destructive things.
They're not living normal lives.
Over the past 30 years, medical professionals have more than doubled their billed visits for patients diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Mark cited studies showing a 40-fold increase in kids diagnosed with bipolar disorder around the year 2000. Abigail was diagnosed in 1999.
When you see bipolar disorder checked on a patient history form, what percentage chance are you thinking this is correct?
Less than 10%.
Wow.
Mark says the reasons for the increase in bipolar diagnoses are complex. But the gist is that in the late 90s, there was both a trendiness and vagueness to the bipolar diagnosis. Like, it seemed to fit a lot of patients who'd been difficult to treat. And these new drugs, known as second-generation antipsychotics, were just hitting the market. They were billed as safe and effective treatments for bipolar disorder, along with a host of other psychiatric problems.
It follows you wherever you go. It's a cloud of depression. And although you've been on an antidepressant for at least 6 weeks, you're frustrated that your depressive symptoms are still with you. Seroquel XR.
And so bipolar, some argue, became a kind of go-to diagnosis for anyone who is depressed but hard to treat. Like a kid who acted out at school, or someone going through a bad breakup.
Once you have a diagnosis, it biases everyone who sees it. I've seen people, you know, they get dragged into the system. Their life becomes being a patient, and they never quite get better because they're not receiving the proper treatment.
After talking to Mark, I spent a lot of hours interviewing experts on this issue at some of the most influential bipolar research centers in the U.S. And the story gets more complicated and contentious from here. Not all the doctors I spoke to agree with Mark's analysis, and we'll get to that.
But talking to Mark Rego did finally confirm to me that I was misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder, that the doctors were wrong, and their mistake caused me a lot of damage. It wasted a lot of my life, my 20s and half my 30s. I felt hurt and angry at my parents, especially my dad, who sent me to those doctors. I had always trusted him to help me get the best care available. We've never talked about it before. I need him to hear my take on all of this.
I'm getting ready for the interview with my dad tonight, and I'm nervous. I think my dad just really wants to be so supportive and helpful, but I think it might get intense. I don't know. I don't know what to expect.
My name is John Kafka. I am 74 years old.
My dad is actually also a doctor, a pediatrician. So he has some background in psychiatric diagnoses. But I wasn't sure how much he remembered about my own history and diagnosis. So I decided to start at the beginning.
What was I like when I was younger?
Spirited, smart. You always stood up for yourself. You just didn't seem like a fearful or anxious kid.
Do you have any memories of me struggling with my mental health before I went away to college?
No. I mean, it might have been there and I might have just overlooked it.
So what was it like for you when you got the news that I was in an emergency room?
I probably at first was a little bit in denial about how serious the situation was. I was worried and terrified, and I felt like a failure as a parent.
I want to talk a little bit about the doctors you took me to in San Diego. What was your sense of the treatment that I was getting at that time?
You know, looking back on it, it was probably not as good as it should have been. But I was sending you to the same group of doctors that I had been sending my patients to for years, that I was obligated by insurance to send my patients to. And it would have been hard for me to acknowledge that you weren't getting the best care.
Neither one of us remembered any manic episodes. But my dad also noticed that I wasn't getting better. Still, I kept seeing the same doctors and trying the same kinds of medications. And this is really what I was holding against him. He didn't ask enough questions at the time.
It's just that what I've kind of come to realize is that I am not and never was bipolar. And I wasn't able to get treatment for the issues that I was really struggling with. And it took years of my life. And I'm really sad and pissed about it.
I mean, that's terrible. But, you know, I'm not going to defend my choice. You know, we can't use a 2024 perspective to look at something 2 decades ago. So if I screwed up, I'm sorry, but looking back on it, I think I was in good faith taking you to experienced and well-trained psychiatrists.
Some of these other experts have told me that they think my case was particularly bad in terms of the length of time that I spent unnecessarily medicated.
Well, I guess to the extent that my actions resulted in that, I would certainly be regretful about that as well. I was doing my best. I had.
There really wasn't much more to say after that, so we moved on to a happier time, in 2015, about a year after I had gotten off the medications. My dad and I went out for dinner to our favorite wood-fired pizza place, where we sat on the patio and shared a bottle of wine. My dad told me he was relieved that he doesn't have to worry about me anymore.
Do you remember that evening and that conversation?
Yes.
How did I look?
You looked like my daughter.
I decided to end the conversation there, at the one place where we could agree. But later that night, after the interview with my dad, in bed with my husband, Philip, I wondered if I should have said more.
I keep thinking of things I wish I had asked and said to my dad.
What is it you wish you had asked?
Like, I wish I had pointed out that the initial idea to send me back to New York alone with a bottle of SSRIs was idiotic. And I wish I had sort of prodded him a little more when he made this declaration that he was sending me to the same doctors that he sent his own patients.
So I think you can still ask him that another time. I think you did a good job, so I wouldn't punish yourself.
I mean, Justin told me, you know, I'm supposed to think of a through line, as he calls it. But right now, the only through line I can think of is, I lost years of my life.
Because you're angry, I think. Which is understandable. And also, it's not going to change because this has happened.
He's right. This has happened. It's not going to change. I kept thinking about his words over the following days and weeks. I kept asking myself, what can I change? What can I do? During that time, Justin checked in to ask me some of the questions he thought people might ask when they hear my story.
I sort of hate to ask, and you can just not answer if you don't want to, but I want to give you an opportunity to.
These were the hard questions, the ones he'd been saving, like...
Does all of this still affect you now, like, day to day?
Well, you know, if I feel energized and happy, I automatically think, am I a healthy amount of happy? I just don't trust my emotions. I don't have bipolar. That's more clear to me now than it ever was. But it's almost like I'm afraid of a relapse of this illness that I know I don't have.
It's been a few weeks since you spoke to your dad. And I'm kind of wondering how you're feeling now about the role your parents played in all of this.
Well, I've watched enough Real Housewives to know that any apology that includes the words if and but isn't a real, genuine apology. Ultimately,
that's where you garnered that?
Yeah, that's where I learned that. And ultimately, it's not the apology I want or need. But also, you know, there were times in my past when I'm pretty sure I would have been homeless and hungry or even dead without the support of my parents. Not everyone has a dad who brings them frozen yogurt in a mental hospital, you know?
How much do you blame the medications for your feelings and the circumstances of your life during this 15-year period?
It's not like I was happy before I took the medications. I was miserable, but I was still functioning. I attributed that to the medications, but also to the circumstances that the diagnosis put me in, which was the feeling that I'm ill. And that really affected the way I viewed myself and my capabilities.
What's the reason you didn't seek out a second opinion for yourself?
I believed them. I had no reason not to, you know? I didn't know that I could or should seek out a second opinion. I'm the child and grandchild of doctors, and I was indoctrinated to think that doctors are right. And at the same time, you know, the fact is I saw a lot of different therapists and psychiatrists. So to me, it was just constantly confirmed that this diagnosis was correct because none of these doctors that I was seeing were questioning the diagnosis.
And this is one of the reasons I decided to finally revisit my past. It became clear to me when doing research for this piece that misdiagnosis of bipolar is a real issue in the U.S. This was true in the late 90s and aughts when I was diagnosed. And it's still true today. So who knows how many people are sitting alone on their sofas with their ceiling fans, watching TV, trapped in this situation, or needing medications or something else that they aren't getting because no one has taken the time to really understand what they're going through. Which is why I wanted to tell this story. Because I want other people to ask the questions I didn't ask. I want other people to advocate for themselves. Not to throw away their medications, but to start a conversation. In a way, I'm making this piece for the person that I was when I was 19.
That was Abigail Kafka. She is a writer and she's working on a memoir. Justin Cramon produced that story. Sound design by Bowen Wong. We just heard Abigail Kafka's story. She's a writer who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder when she was in her 20s. Abigail spent years on medication, not able to really work or have a life, until she slowly got off her medications under the guidance of her doctor. Now she believes that her diagnosis was wrong, that she didn't have bipolar disorder. Some of the experts she talked to say misdiagnosis is common and bipolar disorder is overdiagnosed. But there is a lot of disagreement over this. Justin Cramon, who reported the story with Abigail, interviewed several psychiatrists to better understand the diagnosis and its history, and he's here now to talk more about what he's learned.
I talked to researchers and clinicians at some of the leading bipolar centers in the U.S. Right now, the gold standard for diagnosing bipolar is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5. So you basically see if the patient's responses fit the criteria and symptoms laid out in this book, the DSM-5.
Okay, that sounds fairly straightforward.
Yeah, but it doesn't always shake out that way. One big thing to be aware of is that bipolar research got a lot more complicated in 1994. A new edition of the DSM came out that year, and it created this new subcategory of bipolar disorder, type 2. So classic bipolar, what's now called bipolar 1, has depression alternating with these manic episodes where people are acting really out of character, have a very inflated sense of self-importance. They make massive moves. They can destroy careers, romances, lives, finances. But one of the features of bipolar 2 is a milder form of mania called hypomania. It doesn't last as long, and it isn't as destructive.
So hypo with an O meaning below, the mania is not as visible. And to me, that also sounds like it could be really tricky to see it, to diagnose it.
Add to that that people don't usually seek treatment when they're manic. Mm-hmm. Like they're feeling good. They come in when they're depressed, when they're feeling bad, which means the diagnosis is historical. Like it looks back on a past state. With hypomania, you're basically trying to figure out if someone felt a little too good, like manic good, ever in their past for a brief period of time. And you can see where it starts to get just difficult to judge.
The story brings up this explosion of bipolar diagnoses in the late 90s. Is that because of the addition of the type 2 diagnosis?
So that doesn't completely account for this, what really was an explosion in bipolar diagnoses in the late 1990s. In the second half of the 90s, there was this perfect storm of factors that led to the rise in bipolar diagnoses. First, there was some research about how mood disorders, which include bipolar, were underdiagnosed in U.S. hospitals. And that led to these questionnaires being developed to flag patients who had bipolar, to say basically this is a good candidate to look into further for this disorder. But these questionnaires that were developed, which you can fill out in like 10 or 15 minutes, started to be used not as screeners, but as definitive diagnostic tools, which is not how they're intended. And Abigail told me she filled out like a lot of these over the 15-year period where she carried the bipolar diagnosis. Then came the use of second-generation antipsychotics. These medications were developed in the 1980s, but began to be used to treat bipolar in the mid-1990s. The thought and the marketing thrust was that they could supplement or even replace antidepressants for a lot of the illnesses where antidepressants weren't working. And so bipolar seemed somewhat easy to diagnose with the questionnaires, fairly easy to treat with the drugs. And the sense was that even if the diagnosis was a little off, well, the drugs fixed that too. There was just this excitement, like if you went to medical conferences at that time, I was told, around the whole area of bipolar, that this could solve a lot of problems, streamline care, and make it less expensive.
So that does make it sound like bipolar is overdiagnosed. Is that what you walked away with?
That's where I wanted to be really careful in researching this story. All the circumstantial evidence is there. It's a big claim to say that millions of Americans are misdiagnosed with a life-changing, and by the way, very expensive illness. Some people say that there's a clear line from drug companies pushing new antipsychotics to overdiagnosis. You have doctors like Mark Rago in Abigail's story who do believe there's a huge problem of bipolar overdiagnosis that persists in this country. And here's Claudia Baldassano, a psychiatry professor who directs UPenn's bipolar outpatient program.
Overall, I do think that bipolar disorder is overdiagnosed, especially in the setting of crisis centers, inpatient hospitalizations, especially when there is a comorbid substance abuse. In the crisis center, I would say that probably about a third of patients who come with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder actually have it based on my own diagnosis. So two-thirds, I believe, do not have bipolar disorder. In my faculty practice, the misdiagnosis is at the level of about half from what I see at the crisis center. But still, clearly, there is overdiagnosis in this setting.
Wow, so that's a lot of people. Is there any research on this to quantify these numbers?
So psychiatrist Dr. Mark Zimmerman at Rhode Island Hospital published a paper a while back that also claimed to show overdiagnosis of bipolar disorder since the late 1990s. But I think it's really important to point out that in the sample of doctors I spoke to, there were an equal number who felt, even with the explosion of bipolar diagnosis in the 90s, that the disorder may still be underdiagnosed, that there are just so many people who have it. Here's David Michlowitz, a psychiatry professor at UCLA Semmel Institute.
I would guess underdiagnosed. It's one of the more high reliable diagnoses in the DSM.
A lot of experts believe the accuracy of bipolar diagnosis is no different or even better than many other psychiatric diagnoses. Nasir Ghami directs the mood disorders program at Tufts Medical Center. And he really took issue with the contention that bipolar is overdiagnosed.
Do you think it's different for MDD? Do you think it's different for generalized anxiety disorder? It's the same for every psychiatric diagnosis. And that's not overdiagnosis. That's disagreement.
So where do we go from here? What do we do with this information?
Well, first, I think we often talk about bipolar like it's a yes or no thing, like it's a binary choice. You have it or you don't. And it's just helpful to understand that there's a huge gray area. It's so complicated to diagnose, especially bipolar 2, and there are many cases where it doesn't seem the proper care has been taken either to diagnose or to withhold diagnosis. And then from a patient standpoint, several doctors told me that stories like Abigail's are the ones that are not getting told. Like, we see the cost of underdiagnosing because people hurt themselves or become unhoused. But we rarely talk about the cost of overdiagnosing and overmedicating, what that does to people's lives in the long term, which looks really different, right? But it can cause real suffering also. And it's like a diagnosis that sometimes is made in 20 minutes or 30 minutes in crisis settings is like tying a knot in someone's life, and it can take years or decades to untangle that knot. But at the same time, this is where I want to be really safe talking about this. I don't want the takeaway to be throw out your medications. Bipolar is real. It's clearly dangerous when untreated. What we wanted to do was make a story that empowers patients and doctors to ask questions, that acknowledges uncertainty and encourages people to get second opinions when they're not sure.
Thank you, Justin.
Thanks so much, Mikan.
Justin Cramon is a reporter and producer.